Welcome back to the Cyber Matters podcast, powered by the Cyber Guild. Today, our host is Jamil Evans, President and CTO of Evans & Chambers Technology and Cyber Guild Board of Advisors member. He is joined by our featured guest, Greg Crabb, Principal Consultant for SideChannel and founder of 10-8. Greg is the former CISO of the U.S. Postal Service. He is a respected and sought-after advisor by organizations seeking to protect digital assets and develop and apply best practices and pragmatic cybersecurity strategies.
Hey, Greg, thanks for joining us again today here on Cyber Matters. I know we spoke a couple times before, once last week at our in-person networking event called Cybertunity. So I understand you're from DC. Is that right?
Yeah, thanks for having me here, Jamil. And yeah, I was born in DC, and my folks worked for the FBI. And so, That was the beginning of my time here in Washington. And then I returned to the DC area about 15 years ago to raise my family and my wife and two boys here. We live in Northern Virginia and just love it here.
Nice. So we've got that in common. I'm from DC as well, born and raised in DC. So that's very cool. And that's interesting about your FBI parents are as part of your background. Do you think that encouraged you to get into cyber?
Oh, I think it encouraged me to get into law enforcement. Absolutely. I remember when I was 7 years old, my dad took me into the Hoover building. And I remember just talking about all the cases that he had worked and, you know, some of the old memorabilia of past investigations of Bonnie and Clyde and, you know, all that sort of stuff going way back. And you know, when I was seven, I didn't know who all those people were, but it was just pretty cool to be able to have that experience and to recognize the need that law enforcement has. My 17-year-old, although I was not an FBI agent, I retired as a United States Postal Inspector. My 17-year-old aspires to be an FBI agent. His role model is my business partner, Andrew McCabe, and he's obsessed with anything that has to do with criminology and behavioral science and all that good stuff.
Oh, that's awesome. That's awesome. So how did you actually get into law enforcement? Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Of course. So I had the good occasion of coming out of college and actually working for the Department of Energy's Office of Inspector General. And I started as an auditor. And in 1996, kind of following in my father's trajectory of being in law enforcement, I wanted to become a U.S. postal inspector. My grandfather had been a postal carrier in a small little town in southern Ohio, and I used to love walking the streets in that little town with grandpa, and you know, really understanding the importance of the postal service in connecting that little community. Everybody loved grandpa because he had served them for, you know, decades as their letter carrier. And that really resonated with me. And so I really wanted to become a U.S. postal inspector and really participate in how secure communications are made in the United States. And 1996, the world was a lot different than it is today. The postal service and the importance of communications in the mail were was much greater. However, I think through my career, I understood my need to understand how the economy is changing, how technology is changing the economy, and being part of that push to make the Postal Service a great benefit for the new economy. And you know, little companies like that little thing that Jeff Bezos did out of the back of his truck where he'd pull up to the back of the post office and drop a couple of books off at the post office in order to be able to be delivered, and to see how that has grown. And that was sort of my origins. And you know, due to my audit background, I started in the Postal Service as an IG auditor type, doing financial statement audits, and my responsibility was electronic data processing controls. So for literally 3 or 4 years, all I did was make sure that access control to the mainframes and paychecks were properly distributed and payables were being properly controlled from a security perspective. And then I got rolled out in 1999 to a different function. And we had talked about this a little bit last night, Jamil. So, you know, I'm kind of rolling with some of the questions that we had talked about, but, in 99, I was assigned to work fraudulent workers' compensation investigations. So postal employees that were out with various injuries. And I remember I enjoyed those cases. However, I remember sitting in the back of my surveillance vehicle one afternoon, watching a claimant that had claimed a back injury and was on long-term disability. And, you know, that claimant was pulling all of the household goods out of his home and putting them onto a U-Haul truck to move to Ohio. But that's a different part of the story. I was really fantasizing about cyber and the importance of these technology issues that were really budding and developing, and how e-commerce was becoming such an important topic. And I was out in California, out in San Jose, California. And I remember that afternoon I visualized becoming the Chief Information Security Officer of the United States Postal Service.
Wow. Yeah.
And you know, that put me on a trajectory for the next 15 years of my career to really put my arms around what is the adversarial environment that we face as practitioners. Mm-hmm. And I had the good fortune of a bunch of badges and you know, handcuffs and a gun in order to be able to literally chase cyber criminals to the ends of the world. And that really gave me a great education on you know, how what we face as practitioners today. So I went way too long on your question there. I apologize.
No, that's awesome though. I mean, it's amazing that you were able to visualize and chart a goal for your career to be the CISO of the Postal Service and actually achieve that. It's to me, that's that job is such a critically responsible job of to protect the organization, right? I mean, it sounds like you got your hands into a lot of different areas when it comes to security and understanding risk and operations of the Postal Service. So you're probably well equipped, very well equipped to take on that role. Did you feel, you know, what were some of the challenges that you felt moving into the Postal Service part of this conversation as CISO? Like, what were some of the biggest challenges of protecting the Postal Service?
Yeah, the Postal Service is an amazing hub to a huge ecosystem of senders and receivers, right? Mm-hmm, and, you know, an unbelievable platform to be able to support the nation.
Mm-hmm.
And prior to becoming the CISO, I had been responsible for revenue, product, and global security for the organization. Mm-hmm. And that really gave me a strong understanding of the revenue generating services of the organization, mm-hmm. the product innovations that the organization was making,
mm-hmm.
and also the adversarial situation that we faced from a global security perspective. Mm-hmm. In 2014, I was leading the investigation into a mass data compromise of the Postal Service. We had been notified from some partners that there was some nefarious activity going on that was sourced to a nation state actor. And lo and behold, the investigation that I led ultimately resulted in the identification of the loss of all of our employee data to this nation state. And, you know, it was at the same time as the OPM breach and, you know, the motives of the actor have kind of been played out in the media about their interest in understanding, you know, government employee data. But that was the day that I briefed the Postmaster General was sort of the recognition of the Postmaster General that we needed to have an increased security presence in our information security program. And I was able to inherit what the program had been. It, you know, just from a context perspective, the Postal Service is a huge organization. Annually, our revenues are over $70 billion. Last year, they were $78 billion. Over 600,000 employees, 31,000 retail locations. Literally, the carrier comes to 160 million addresses every day in the United States. We have hundreds of plants, 300 plants across the United States that have operational technology that move the mail. And so you can imagine all of the complexities of a large manufacturing type operation, a large retail organization. You know, that was what we walked into, what I walked into. And my information security practice that I inherited was 20 employees, 20 contractors, and a $10 million budget.
Wow.
And, you know, that, to say that that was woefully under-resourced is an understatement, clearly.
Okay. Right? Well, you answered the next question I had, but I assumed so. Yeah.
Wow. And so over the next 3 years, I grew the program into a right-sized cybersecurity practice for the organization and had the good fortune of leading about 450 professionals dedicated to protecting the mail and packages of every household in America every day, which was just an honor. And I did that for 6 years and really, you know, have all of the battle scars of a CISO and also all the triumphant stories of, you know, the challenges that we overcome came to be able to do that successfully.
Yeah. Well, that's amazing. You know, I'm struck because in my undergraduate education, I took a networking course and through the course of my career, of course, computer networks have been, you know, critical to everything. But it's really interesting to me that the parallels between computer networking, the internet, TCP, all those kinds of things, and the Postal Service. So the fact that you mentioned as a postal inspector, I mean, each of those letters contains data. That data needs to be protected. That data, and that's how networks work. Data travels in packets that, you know, have a from and to. That needs to happen quickly. It needs to happen securely. It's interesting to think of the parallels and protecting physical paper or physical paper mail. You know, if you're able to, I'm wondering if the process of being able to inspect and protect and to get that optimized, does that help you? Did that help you when you move into the cyber realm and it starts to get into digital security? Did that help you? Do you see the parallels there?
Absolutely. I think one of my favorite quotes about the post office is from Seinfeld in the late 90s. And Jerry's mailman, you know, everybody remembers Newman. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they love to hate Newman, but one of my favorite lines is Newman would say, it was when you control the mail, you control information. And, you know, to your point, Jamil, you know, it's about information and securely transmitting information. Mm-hmm. And some of those characteristics around confidentiality, integrity, availability, something that's extremely important to a postal inspector. And we live and breathe by this particular philosophy is sanctity. That sanctity of the mail, that when you put a letter in the mailbox, it's not going to be read. It's going to maintain those privacy characteristics all the way through the life cycle. And so for me, that is, those are the characteristics that are, I think, really important. As we talk about this from a risk management discussion, because those are the fundamental risk parameters that every risk officer should be thinking about relative to the integrity of their information and communications within their organizations.
Yeah, and that makes sense from a Postal Service perspective. That's critical. It's reputation almost. It's a confidence of the customer. Yeah, we take it for granted today that if we put something in the mail, it's going to get there and no one's going to have opened it. I don't think I've really ever had anything be tampered with that I know of that I've sent, and you take it for granted. But the one time that there's a big issue with that, and which kind of takes us to the elections. I mean, can you talk a little bit about the 2020 election? That was a huge undertaking that the USPS took on to handle the election there.
Absolutely. And, you know, I'm just grateful, you know, we're sitting right at the back end of the 22 elections. And, you know, it's just an amazing system of the whole election process in the United States, this system of state and local election authorities that really band together in order to be able to put on a seamless show every 2 years. And, you know, I was fortunate in 2020 to be leading the charge at the Postal Service relative to obviously securing all the technology for the election. You know, the one thing that people don't necessarily think about is the Postal Service is the only provider for every election authority in the United States. So, you know, I think its roots really go back to making sure that the military could have mail-in ballots in order to be able to vote while they were overseas.
Right.
But, you know, mail-in balloting has now become the standard in several states. And you know, I think in 2020, it was so important because of COVID.
Yes, yes.
We were concerned as a society about the spread of COVID, what was going to happen by bringing all of the citizens together to elect, you know, to election authorities and to polling places. And so the post office played a key role in that 2020 election, and, you know, not without a little controversy.
Oh yeah.
Sure. Obviously. I mean, you know, it was early on, that, some of the political leaders were talking about the concerns of mail-in balloting and, you know, the integrity of that whole process. And, you know, one of the first things that I did was really called upon my friend Chris Krebs, and you know, we partnered to be able to support that 2020 election, and my team was hand in hand with him in those weeks and months as we kind of got up to the election. And you know, obviously, you know, you're checking every door, window, and crevice in order to be able to assure that, you know, the technology, particularly the operational technology, the organization was secure in order to be able to properly sort the mail for the election, for citizens and for the election authorities. After it was all said and done, we moved on the inbound side into election authorities, 70 million ballots, which represented 45% of the general election. And, you know, I know there's a lot of controversy people talk about, but quite frankly, it's never been proven that anything was bad. And, you know, Chris Krebs was, you know, obviously really chastised for running such a great election and lost his job as a result of it. But really, my hat's off to Chris and making sure that we had all of that operational threat intelligence that we needed in order to be able to cover off on any issues that were was to develop.
Awesome. Yeah, that's I know. Yeah, there's a lot of scrutiny over all of that. I wonder. I know that. And we got to get to more of the risk talk here in a second. But it's a really interesting topic to me because of all the recounts and things that had to happen. I just wonder how much scrutiny Postal Service came under to maybe prove that all the votes were delivered, none were tampered with. I mean, I wonder if there's a lot of extra work that had to be done after.
There was extra work going on during.
And during, yeah.
And making sure that we had, that no ballot is left behind, right? That election authorities have everything that was in the possession of the Postal Service as quickly as possible, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
There's a new priority. So, typically it's first class mail and then bulk business mail, from a hierarchy perspective. When the election is on, there's only one thing to deliver, and that's ballots.
That
right?
makes complete sense. Yeah. Definitely.
So you can only imagine. I mean, we were on calls constantly to make sure that we had properly, from an operational perspective, moved all of the ballots into the election authorities. And I'm sure that's what they did earlier this week.
So what are your thoughts on, do you think that voting will go online? Is this like, does this experience of maybe now we're more comfortable with mail-in voting? Maybe it's been tested. Nothing has been proven to be wrong with it. Or faulty or fraudulent with it. Does that make it easier to move to an online voting system?
Jamil, I had the great occasion to try to pilot from an innovation perspective some online methods for voting, and very complementary to making sure that there was a mail piece for each electronic ballot so that we could have kind of a dual system of checks and balances. And
okay,
let me just say it's very political.
yeah. That is not surprising. Yeah. Understood.
I'll leave it at that, my friend.
Yeah. I hear that.
I could spend probably, hours talking to you about, we broke down the process in the election. It's a life cycle, right? Lean Six Sigma, understand value, where value is created in the process, break it down, make sure that it's input into the technology controls. We worked for, had a whole team dedicated to that. And so we can speak at offline. About that.
Love to. Yeah. But it sounds like you're saying it's not a technical hurdle. It's not a security hurdle. It's more of a, there are some other things that are in the way of making that a reality.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Got it. So moving more into the risk, because as you know, when we, the last event that you spoke, in for us at the Cyber Guild here, we talked about how to talk risk so that executives and your board and your customers will really listen. And a lot of this was about GRC governance, risk, and compliance and the importance of that. I know you've got some background there, and you have clients that you support through helping them strengthen their cybersecurity posture in these ways. And compliance is obviously very important. So my first question for you is, looking at my own organization and others like us that we work with, a lot of times, what really drives us to get smart with our cybersecurity posture is really what helps us sell our product or services better. And so a lot of times, as we all know, compliance is required pretty much to make the sale. And then that is really what leads everything. We got to get the SOC too. So, all right, we're missing a few things here. Let's start putting the minimum in place that we need to put in place to comply with SOC 2, which might be minimal governance. Risk, we're kind of not really thinking about. We're just looking to get through the SOC 2. So
yep.
what is that sounds like the way that I've seen a lot of organizations work with this. Is that your experience as well?
Absolutely. I think that there are a minimum set of security controls that are table stakes for any organization. And getting a ISO 27001 or SOC 2 certification is just an assurance that you are meeting those minimum requirements. And then elevating the risk discussion is so much more important for an organization and a different set of skills. It's not about compliance. It's about understanding the business value of the services that support your revenue, the assets that support those services, and really making sure that you know what the crown jewels are that are driving your organization. And, you know, when you look at an organization like the Postal Service, we understand, you know, that, you know, I talked about some of those key assets, you know, when you're talking about a retail organization with 31,000 facilities, bringing in money, you've got to look out for those retail assets in order to be able to deliver those ballots. You've got to have all of that operational technology because that's key services. That's a great articulation of understanding how your revenue is tied to your key services and the assets that are associated with them. And then a lot of organizations need to really stay true to measurement criteria and recognize that, you know, I love making analogies between financial controls and technology risk controls. It's my belief that income statement, a balance sheet, a statement of cash flows are risk management tools from a financial perspective.
Agreed.
And when we as information technology risk professionals can articulate our work in the context of the financial situation of an organization, materiality is a big issue. I think some practitioners don't necessarily understand that you can't go run and chase down every single asset till you've got, you know, everything buttoned down. You need to recognize that there are materiality constructs that really can drive better decision-making for your organization. And when you as a risk practitioner can talk in material terms about the impacts of your cyber controls to your leadership and board, you are talking their language. And you know, when you know, vulnerability management, for example, what's material from a vulnerability management perspective for your organization? How many CISOs can answer that question? And I see too many CISOs talking about their vulnerabilities to their board without a materiality understanding.
Meaning, you know, how does that, you know, if there's a breach, if there's some vulnerabilities exploited, how does that impact the revenue of the organization? How does that impact the ability for the company to exist? The customers, are they going to stay? Is that what you're getting at?
Completely. Yeah. So no good CFO is going to go in front of his board and talk about the few account payables or that haven't been cleared, or the few account receivables that are coming in. They would be laughed out of the boardroom. And we've got CISOs that are going into the boardroom talking about issues that are not material to the organization.
Right. And,
you know, I think that's an area where there's a lot of opportunity for growth from an information practitioner perspective.
Yeah.
And they're really the need to align with the business.
That makes complete sense.
You know, where's the money coming from? Where's the most material risk for the organization? You know, in you know, I can tell old war stories now. one of the war stories that there's a couple that I really like. One of them was about WannaCry and not Petya. So Shadow Brokers, you know, recount of the story just briefly. Shadow Brokers was a hacking group that broke into NSA, a stolen exploit that ultimately became what was the vulnerability that was leveraged by Russia in order to be able to attack Ukraine for WannaCry and not Petya. You know, the threat actors, poorly targeted attack, you know, kind of, I think it educated them on the being a lot more targeted, but it impacted, WannaCry impacted so many organizations. We as security practitioners had about a 3-week window between when the intelligence community and Microsoft released the patch to be able to address the NSA vulnerability and when WannaCry hit. At the time, I was acting very quickly. I understood the consequences of an NSA level remote code executable vulnerability that could get privileged access. I knew I needed to be able to patch every system. When WannaCry hit, we were at about 95% patching. Now, 95% patching was pretty good. But still, I had, you know, think about how many computers. I was responsible for the security of 1.2 million computers. 95% of those computers, the Microsoft computers, were patched in my environment. There's a number that were not patched. Mm-hmm. However, we had prioritized the patching. We knew the dependencies that we had from a third-party perspective. Mm-hmm. I was solid that day when WannaCry hit. I knew that those systems that had not been patched weren't very exposed to the internet, and I didn't think that we would have an issue. My business partner, one of the most important organizations from a partnership perspective, FedEx, was decimated as a result of WannaCry.
Oh, wow.
And they're my biggest trading partner. They move all the express and priority mail of the United States Postal Service. And, you know, I think that's a demonstration of you need to understand the materiality of your vulnerability management program and recognize that 100% is maybe not always necessary, but you need to understand the business consequences if it isn't. And, you know, that to me, you know, we as soon as we found out that, you know, well, we found out pretty quick because from our operational perspective, FedEx was unable to move our first class and our express mail and our priority mail through their Memphis hub for over a week. And, you know, we were battening down every hatch and, you know, that was just an excellent example, I think, of understanding those business consequences in the context of the game that we play as information security practitioners to manage technology risk.
Yeah, that illustrates it really clearly, you know, and as a founder myself, you know, I know that that's a big issue out there. You know, like you said, looking at the financial statements is clear, looking at your product or service and making that better is clear. Risk sounds like something that could happen one day. I'm not sure what the ROI is for me to put my energy there and looking into, you know, truly mitigating risk and looking at those critical assets and playing that game out to see what happens if there is something that does occur. I know that that's got to be something that is really underserved in most corporations and organizations out there, especially on the small business scale. It seems to me that it's best to, you know, for any small business to find a consultant who can come in and take an eye from the outside to look in and help you understand, hey, what are my risks and how important are they? What are my assets? You know, that's just something that small business owners aren't generally directly focused on. So I really think that what you're saying makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, I think right on, Jamil. I've had the great occasion now after 18 months. 18 months ago, I rebranded as a cybersecurity consultant, and I've had the opportunity to support large agencies like DHS and the United Nations, and then smaller organizations and law firms and defense contractors and such. And to your point, this whole aspect of understanding and managing that tie between what's really driving your organization from a revenue perspective, and how is your technology helping you to gain more customers? How is your technology able to operate within adversarial environments? And your business partners are adversarial environments. FedEx was an adversarial environment to me, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
And, I've got other stories that I can tell. The Pitney Bowes story is a great one, but when they got just decimated by a ransomware attack, and literally Pitney Bowes is the connection for the Postal Service to tens of thousands of small companies. And as a result of the security construct that we had around assuring that our postage meters operated properly within an adversarial environment, that data model and the integrity that we had in the operations allowed us to certify our financial statements in spite of our biggest postage partner, Pitney Bowes, being completely owned from a ransomware perspective. And our shared customer base was able to operate from a postage perspective, which was just amazing. And, it goes to understanding how to operate your technology as well as your data model in that adversarial environment that you do business in.
It makes sense. Yeah. Kind of a zero trust kind of thing. Definitely.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. So last question for you is really around 2023. As we move into the new year, what's around the corner from a cybersecurity perspective? What are your thoughts on that?
I think the first thing is budgets. The cost of money is increasing for organizations. CFOs are not going to have the access to investment capital, and it's going to be more expensive for them to borrow money. Information security and technology risk practitioners are going to have to go forward with better business cases in order to show the return that those investments will make for the organization. Mm-hmm. And, every interest rate increase is going to make it that much more difficult for risk practitioners to argue in tightened budgets. And I think some of these levers that we talked about need to be reconfirmed often with leadership teams, with the management of the leadership, because they'll be making decisions relative to terminating lines of business potentially because of return or the amount of investment that's necessary in that line of business. The technology and assets, the services and assets that support that line of business may no longer be as important to the company. So we really need to take a look at budgets and our investment arguments from a return on security investment perspective. And then the threat environment. As a law enforcement, prior 25-year law enforcement professional, last year we saw Russia basically make cyber an instrument of war. And that has huge impacts that we need to understand from a critical infrastructure protection perspective in the United States. Mm-hmm. And, no one would have put SolarWinds on the list of critical infrastructure for an organization.
True.
Right? Mm-hmm. And so SolarWinds didn't see themselves as a target. Mm-hmm. And you know, so many SaaS companies out there don't see themselves as a target.
Right.
So, you know, as we understand and move forward with using more SaaS applications in our business, we need to recognize that those, I hate to say that this, but they're adversarial relationships that we need to understand as technology risk officers. So those are the couple of things that I'm really looking to be able to support organizations on in 2023. And, you know, what folks need to really be looking over their shoulder to think about.
Excellent. Yeah, that makes sense. Those are two things that are definitely happening next year. And I love your approach to how to deal with those. So, well, thanks, Greg. I really appreciate you taking the time. And thanks again for joining us.
Thank you, Jamil. I appreciate the opportunity and grateful to be part of the Cyber Guild.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us for another episode of Cyber Matters, powered by the Cyber Guild. You can follow us on LinkedIn at the Cyber Guild or visit our website, www.cyberguild.org. If you liked this episode, please download and subscribe to our podcast. And check back monthly for more episodes featuring top leaders in cybersecurity.